Tune in at 10 p.m. Thursday, June 19th for our What the Festival broadcast here on KBOO Community Radio. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor for ALEC Expo's film screening and workshop on June 18th, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. ALEC, the American Legislators Exchange Council, is a corporate-directed organization which writes model legislation for state legislatures around the nation that is beneficial to multinational corporations. Secretive corporate-directed and funded organizations like ALEC undermine the principles of citizens participating in democratic processes. ALEC Expos explain how ALEC functions, who is involved, and how to fight back to promote democratic, non-corporate values. Again, that's ALEC Expos, June 18th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you do have it tuned to KBOO Portland, and coming right up is the Digital Divide. So stay listening.
And welcome to the Digital Divide. This is your host, Rabia Yeaman. And today, we've got two exciting segments for you. First, I'm going to be talking live in the studio with Reed Beals about the upcoming Open Source Bridge 2015 conference. That's happening June 23rd through the 26th. And Reed is a designer, developer, and community organizer. He's been involved with Open Source Bridge for 7 years since its inception and has served as a conference co-chair for 5. Reed co-founded Stumptown Syndicate, the nonprofit organization that runs Open Source Bridge and other community-focused technology events in Portland. He's also one of the instigators and core developers of the super awesome Caligator, Portland's tech calendar, and ePDX, a directory of the people, companies, and user groups that make up Portland's tech community. Welcome, Reed.
Hi there. Thank you.
Upcoming is the Open Source Conference that's called Open Source Bridge. Tell us, what is it?
Yeah, so Open Source Bridge is a kind of technology agnostic open source conference that's focused on building open source community and focused on this concept of open source citizenship. And we have 4 days of conference content. We have 3 days of technical talks. And there's over 100 sessions at this year's conference focusing on a wide range of things, anywhere from kind of deep dive technical topics to more things about the community and how we interact with people when we're running or participating in open source projects. The fourth day of the conference is a community-driven unconference. So people show up on Friday morning and set their own agenda for the day and make up sessions on that day. And it's a good way to kind of synthesize things that people have been learning about throughout the week.
So in the doc on the website, and it talked, one thing that caught my attention was a little blurb about open source citizenship. And what it said was, what are the rights and responsibilities of an open source citizen? We're exploring what open source means to us, what it offers, where we struggle, and why we do this day in and day out, and even when we're not paid for it. So tell me, what does it mean to be an open source citizen? What is that?
Yeah, so That's a concept that one of our co-founders, Audrey Eshright, came up with during the first year of the conference. And we were kind of talking about how this isn't something that when you're working within open source technologies and you're working with often large global communities of people who aren't necessarily all in one place, and you're usually doing volunteer work on these projects, there's a lot more than just show up, throw some code in, and go home. There's a lot of things around how we run communities, how we interact with people, how we make spaces that are welcoming for new participants and new contributors. And so we just kind of wanted to explore that. And another thing is we'd seen a lot of technology conferences that were very focused on a single technology or focused on breaking things down into tracks these are all the people who are working with Ruby, these are all the people who are working with Python, other sorts of language-specific or technology-specific tracks. And we kind of wanted to break out of that and have a technology-agnostic conference that would allow more cross-pollination between disciplines and allow people to learn things that they wouldn't necessarily be exposed to in their day-to-day life. So we wanted also to kind of get between technical and non-technical roles. So we have a lot of people who are doing technology interacting with people who are doing community management or people who are doing technical writing or documentation or other related topics, that all of these roles have to work together in order to have a successful project.
So it's not just for programmers.
Not necessarily. We've built this whole thing around, it is a technical conference. There are certainly technical talks that are kind of deep dive into very esoteric small things, but they're not
language specific, is
right,
what I'm hearing.
Right. I mean, there are talks that are specific to a specific language, but that's not how we chose them. We didn't say we're looking for talks in this language. We said we're looking for technical talks, and we're also looking for talks on a variety of other topics. So we have kind of a five track structure, and actually one of the most popular tracks or topics that people submit into is our community track. And that's where a lot of the kind of day-to-day experiences about what it takes to run a successful project and what it takes to collaborate with people and bring things together in order to sort of build things in this open and collaborative way.
Well, that's really interesting, because I would think, as a non-programmer myself, just on the outside, oh, this is about open source coding, and we hear the word hacker, and I think the word hacker, you know, originally was just a cliche of someone in a basement on television, but it really isn't that. So tell us more about what that word means. How do we define that or redefine it?
Yeah, I mean, in the context of Open Source Bridge, we use that term. We have at our conference a space that we call the Hacker Lounge, and it's sort of our open space for collaboration and working on projects or any other sorts of things during the conference. It's kind of our main social space. And we define that term in a very open, like, not hacking in the we're breaking into things and intruding and big scary things, but kind of breaking things down, figuring out how they work, putting them back together.
Like deconstructing and reconstructing.
Yeah.
And maybe it morphs in the reconstructing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good way to think of it? Or is it like the maker movement for the digital world?
Yeah, it's all of that sort of thing. It's making things. And in our sort of ethos, we're definitely pushing that in a very collaborative way.
So what would non-coders get out of attending? So people that don't code, they could observe, or they could write, or what
yeah.
What are the opportunities for them?
There are a lot of there's actually a lot of conference content that is certainly accessible to non-coders.
Can you tell us about some of the groups or conferences that people can attend during the 3 days or those sessions or what?
I don't have a good grasp of our entire 100-session lineup off the top of my head.
So 100 sessions?
Yeah, we have five tracks. And so those tracks range from being kind of very low-level techie things to kind of, we have a business track and we have a culture track, and both of those are much more focused on kind of, like I was saying earlier, how people collaborate and also kind of how people use these technologies in a business context. So that there's a very wide range of things. And even within some of our more technical tracks, we definitely have a lot of beginner level things. We have a lot, we try really hard to get a wide range of audience level content. So we don't have everything at the highest, most complicated level. We want to have the conference be very accessible. That's actually one of the things that we've worked on over the years, is keeping the conference accessible to as many people as possible. We try to keep our ticket costs as low as we can. We try to offer lower student tickets. We have a program where people who volunteer for 8 hours helping us run the conference can get a free admission to the conference. So there's a lot of things that we're trying to do to open things up, make spaces where people feel welcome, make spaces where people can come together and learn things, even if they're not experts. We certainly don't want this to be an experts only event. We want a whole range of participants.
The whole community.
Yeah, exactly.
Something for everybody. So are there speakers that are, you know, hosting workshops? And
yeah. So we have, as I said, we have 100 sessions, and those 100 sessions are speakers from really all over the world. We get submissions. A lot of people are local, but we get submissions from Europe and Australia and Africa. And we've had people coming from India and the Philippines and a number of other places to present at the event. So we open up an open call for proposals early in the year, around February. And then we select from those. We have a selection committee that goes through everything and comments and figures out what the best talks are. And that's always a really, really hard process. Like we get far more excellent talks than we're able to accept. And that's always the worst part, that, you know, we only have so much time. But all these people come, they fly in or drive in if they're local. And
that's awesome. Yeah. So what year, how many years have you been doing this Bridge conference?
Yeah. So Open Source Bridge, this is our 7th year.
Wow.
Yeah, we started in 2009 and have done conferences every year since then.
And it sounds like it's growing and gaining more international recognition.
Yeah, it's definitely kind of growing and gaining a community around it that exists outside of Portland. There are a lot of people here, obviously, who love this conference and come every year, but there are also a lot of people who come from all over the country and all over the world each year to attend this and be in this group of people.
Do you see the Bridge conference growing and expanding outside of Oregon to other locations to make it more accessible?
We've talked about that, but at this point, it's sort of a several years in the future pipe dream, in that we're an all volunteer run event. The conference is put on by Stumptown Syndicate, which is a nonprofit that we founded to run Open Source Bridge and other kind of technology events in Portland. But everybody who works on our kind of core planning committee and everyone who's on the Stumptown Syndicate board is a volunteer. And so we all have day jobs. We're all working on other things. We would really love to be able to sort of have a few people take on working on this thing full time and be able to take it out of Portland and have like franchised other events in other places, because we've gotten interest in that. We have had people come to us and say, I want to run one of these events in my city. And we said, wait a while, because it's complicated. But it's something that we wouldn't rule out necessarily, but it's not coming next year or anything along those lines.
Right. So in this essentially pretty short amount of time that the conference lasts, what type of projects can people create, you know, in so little time and with such a diversity of skills?
We haven't had a huge number of projects that just came out of only these 4 days. But what we've definitely had is connections that were made, projects that were started, people who have met for the first time and then gone on to collaborate. So a lot of times we'll have existing projects that come together at our conference and their whole team meets up here. They're not necessarily geographically located otherwise, but their whole team comes together and meets up and works on things. Sometimes we've had smaller local projects have definitely just spawned, and they've been like a small little thing, and those have happened during the week of the conference. But for the most part, it's not about getting everything done while you're here. It's about making connections and building relationships that will sort of sustain collaboration throughout the rest of the year.
How would you define like the group, the people that come to the conference? Would you say that it's not just a bunch of guys? It's not just a bunch of hacker dudes.
Yeah.
That women can feel totally comfortable. And I know that our news director, Jenka, she said this will be her fourth year attending.
Yeah.
So would you call the event, it's inclusive and welcoming?
I would definitely say so. We've worked very hard to try to make it so. And as a result of kind of explicitly inviting people to participate and building policies that make people feel welcome and unthreatened, we've gotten a huge increase in sort of the number of submissions from traditionally underrepresented groups in technology. So this year we didn't do any kind of like skewing our selection process, but just due to the number of submissions that we have, I think, over 50% women speaking at our conference, which is very rare in kind of technology conferences in general. So we usually have a fairly diverse speaker base and thus a fairly diverse attendee base. It's something where we're doing a lot of outreach and doing a lot of efforts to make that possible. One thing that we're excited about this year is this is the first year that we've been able to offer on-site childcare at the event. So
that's really exciting.
Yeah, this is one of the things we've talked to parents over the years, and they've said, we want to come and we want to both come and we can't because somebody has to stay home with the kids. And so we're trying to figure out how to make that work. We're kind of trying to figure out how to make the spaces that we build welcoming to everybody who is involved in technology and everyone who uses technology, because even if you have groups that are underrepresented in technology as a whole, they're still using technology and they're still affected by technology. And we want these movements and we want these things to be for everybody. We don't want them to just be exclusive to a few people. So
the event, it's not just about software development. It's about collaborating. It's about technology in the community. It is an opportunity to learn about programming if you want to, and coding, and what's involved. So that is really exciting. So would you tell our listeners where they can learn more about the event?
Yeah. So our website is opensourcebridge.org, and it's spelled how it sounds. And you can go there to find out more information. Registration is still available. We're also doing a sort of interesting fundraising thing at the moment for the conference. A group of people from Portland's Women Who Hack group decided to get together and are trying to crowdfund a like takeover sponsorship of our Hacker Lounge space. So they're trying to add sparkles and ponies to our Hacker Lounge.
Is it Christy?
She's the other co-chair of the conference. This is a number of other people.
So wait. Let's get back to sparkles.
But yes, sparkles. So the Women Who Hack group started this fundraiser to sponsor our Hacker Lounge this year, and it's going relatively well. It's got about 50% of the funds raised for that at this point. So that's also kind of an interesting thing that we didn't expect. This was this group that came to us and we're like, we want to do this. Is this okay? And we're like, yes. So we have...
That sounds fun.
Yeah, it definitely sounds fun. It was one of these things where we didn't have any large company this year take on our kind of Hacker Lounge sponsorship, which is something that we've had in the past. And we've always said with that sponsorship, if you buy this sponsorship, we'll let you have some say in the decoration of the Hacker Lounge. And so they're trying to raise funds to take that sponsorship slot, which is kind of interesting and exciting.
That's awesome.
And so we're going to have information about that on our website soon. It's not up, I don't think, right now, but
So give us the dates again, yes, and the website again and the location, yeah, where the event will be. And also, can people buy tickets at the door to go in?
Yeah. So it's opensourcebridge.org is our website. The conference is June 23rd through 26th in downtown Portland, Oregon. It's at the Elliott Center, which is the classroom and kind of event space that's attached to the First Unitarian Church. And so we're in there. We really love working with that venue. They kind of share a lot of the values that our conference shares, and we've been able to work with them really well. And so in terms of registration for the conference, you can buy tickets at the door. We have both full conference passes and one-day passes available. You can also register on our website, which helps us better plan for food and other sorts of things throughout the conference. We have, as I said earlier, our volunteer shifts are now open for registration. So if you're interested in volunteering during the conference, you can look on our website for information on that. There's a whole calendar of volunteer shifts that you can pick and choose from and help us out when running the conference.
Thank you so much for coming in today and telling us about it. I'm looking forward to going to some workshops, and I sure hope it's going to be another booming year for you guys.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think we're all really excited, and sort of the last week before the conference. So,
okay, thanks so much for being with us today on The Digital Divide.
Thank you so much for having
me.
Bye,
Ree.
It's just another day on earth. Oh, it's just another day. Just another day. It's just another day on earth. It's just another day on earth. It's just another day on earth. One day we will put it on.
And we are back. We're listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. This is your host, Rabia Yeaman. And coming up next, we're going to hear an excerpt from an interview with Dr. Robert Wachter, author of The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. He'll be interviewed with independent radio producer and former weekly KBOO host, Andrew Geller. You'll be able to get there. You can look at the program episode for today at kboo.fm, which has a link, I think, to that audio or information about that link. Also, put up a special TED Talk on the nature of reality for you, so you might want to check that out. It's a great TED Talk. Now, most of us don't remember, maybe some of us do, but there was a time when doctors didn't take any notes at all when you visited them. And as the quality and detail of the note became increasingly important, the physical distance grew between the patient and the doctor. Today, it's increasingly common for doctors to touch a computer more than their patient during the visit. What are the implications of this? Now, this and many other aspects of the digitization of medicine are thoroughly described in the new book by Dr. Robert Wachter. The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. In the conversation with independent radio producer Andrew Geller, Dr. Wachter explains that the changes are profound, irreversible, sometimes contradictory, and most certainly not static. In an extended excerpt of their full interview, they focus the history as well as the pros and cons of these developments. Dr. Robert Wachter is a professor and associate chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, as well as the Chief of Medical Service and the Division of Hospital Medicine at UCSF Medical Center. He was named the most influential physician in the U.S. by Modern Healthcare Magazine and has authored over 250 articles and 6 books. The Digital Doctor is now a New York Times Science bestseller. The full hour-long interview will be available at Andrew Geller's blog, at Audio Insight, that's I-N-C-I-T-E, and podcast via iTunes. Okay, let it rip.
Can you talk a little bit about the pros and cons of having more extensive patient medical records?
Well, the pros, you'd sort of want everything about a patient that's relevant to their care to be in their medical record, not only from the standpoint of what the individual doctor needs to know and remember and communicate to other physicians to care for that patient appropriately, but there are other legitimate purposes of the note. So the note becomes the grist for medical research. If we're trying to figure out what is the best way to take care of patients with breast cancer, how else can you do that but look at the notes from 100 patients with breast cancer and see what treatments were given and how the patients did? If something goes wrong, the idea of the note supporting what the doctor did or not supporting it in the context, for example, of a malpractice suit, the note legitimately becomes the record of what the doctor did and what the doctor was thinking. In the modern era, there's a general belief in patient autonomy and patients having a right to see what's in their note and access their data. And so the note now becomes the way for the patient in some systems to be able to see what was on the doctor's mind and what all of their studies showed. And it is the way that we communicate with other doctors, because in the old days, you had one doctor who did everything, and then we invented specialists. We decided that if you have a very specific heart problem or cancer, you probably want to see someone who's a specialist. And so the note took on a coordinative function and a communication function when the patient was seeing multiple clinicians. So these are all legitimate functions, but each one of them adds significant complexity. And in some ways, part of the challenge is we have not reimagined the note. We still have the same structure of kind of a linear narrative, but on top of it, we've overlaid all sorts of other requirements, and the note hasn't matured even as we switch from paper to digital. If you think about the way we record and communicate all sorts of other things in modern society as we've gone digital, I mean, think about Wikipedia or think about Facebook or Twitter, we've kind of reimagined the way communication occurs, whereas in the medical record, we haven't really been that creative.
We'll get to the electronic medical records in just a moment, but one of the things that I found really interesting that you pointed out quite early in the book is that alongside this progression of patient medical record keeping has been increased distancing between the physician and the patient through time.
Yeah, it's a very interesting phenomenon. Again, going back 2,000 years, all the physician could do was talk to and listen to the patient, because we hadn't even invented the physical examination. Nobody really knew what they might be feeling for. And then we developed tools that allowed us to gather more information than we had previously. The information that the patient tells us about his or her symptoms is awfully important, but we learned that you might gather more information about the state of the liver by pushing in the belly in a certain portion and seeing what happened. And then we learned that you could actually listen to the heart, believe it or not, by putting your ear to a patient's chest. But that became a little bit awkward, particularly when the physician was a male and the patient was a female. And a physician named Laennec a couple of hundred years ago had the idea of rolling up a sheet of paper and using it as a sort of megaphone to hear the patient's heartbeat. And this became, of course, the earliest stethoscope. And that began really something that's been quite interesting, which is the separation of the physician from the patient, in the case of the stethoscope, by a mere 18 inches. But over time, increasingly for a physician to take care of a patient effectively, it was no longer just hearing about what the patient was saying or even feeling the patient's belly or listening to their heart. It became a situation in which we needed to look at the results of x-rays or the results of laboratory studies. So this tension between the doctor-patient relationship being an intimate person-to-person and hands-on kind of affair to one in which, yeah, the discussion was important, the feeling of the patient's body parts through the physical exam was important, but there were other portals of information that were coming in, became sort of a theme of medicine over the last 100 and 150 years. Not a pernicious one, really. In some ways, a fundamental tension where we want to do the best we can for patients. We have to take advantage of all the sources of information. And now they're not coming simply through the direct personal interactions between two human beings, but through these other lenses.
Let's look at the beginning of desire to digitize medical records. When did that first become a vision, and when were the earliest efforts at doing so?
Well, it really became a vision when there were visions of computers. And certainly as soon as the earliest computers came into being, medicine was touted as one of the first, as the computer designers like to say, use cases for information technology, in that it is important, it's expensive, it's largely data-driven, and you have some ways a setup for computerization. You have a huge amount of information that needs to be sifted through, recorded, remembered, and the information comes in multiple flavors. One is the patient's information over time, meaning their kind of longitudinal record, what happened to them 10 years ago, and that they're allergic to penicillin, and the progression of a given disease over the course of time. And at the same time, you have the Venn diagram with the literature of medicine, which in the early days might have been hundreds or thousands of articles a year, and then very quickly grew to tens of thousands and even hundreds of thousands of articles a year. And so the idea that a single human being, no matter how smart and no matter how good the medical school, could keep up with all of that information, both the patient's individual information and all the information about the evidence in medicine, became laughable. And so computers were clearly going to be important as a way of recording the information and allowing humans to extend our limited cognitive bandwidth to remember things and analyze things in ways that computers could do. And very early in the course of things, the 50s, you begin to see articles and early experts in healthcare information technology touting the idea of an electronic record and beginning to tout the idea of artificial intelligence, beginning to sort of talk about, well, what the doctor does is take in a whole bunch of data, sift through it in certain ways based on his or her knowledge and education and algorithms and analysis. You know, why can't a computer do that? And if a computer did that, they'd probably do it better, and they wouldn't get tired and grumpy and wouldn't have all the biases that doctors have. And so you began to see, even in the 1960s, the early development of some artificial intelligence tools. And you see writings back then about predictions that we can do away with doctors in 5 or 10 years because these artificial intelligence tools will take over for the doctors.
To me, it seems like one of the places that's had the biggest and earliest unintended consequences has been the radiology departments at hospitals. Could you talk a little bit about the impact from health IT on what are now very lonely people, it seems?
Yeah, that was a surprising aspect of my research. If you're a physician and I'm an internist and a hospitalist, I take care of patients in hospitals, we've always tended to see radiologists having won the game. They make a very good income. They tend to have banker's hours. And they're sitting there reading x-rays and kind of interesting. And one of the things I found was that radiologists are a pretty unhappy lot these days. And the reason is this. In the old days, when I ordered an x-ray on one of my patients in the hospital, I always then went down to the radiology department. And it was a ritual. In every radiology department, the teams of doctors of medicine like I am or surgeons came through the radiology department like cars going through a car wash, and had this exchange with the radiologist who sat in front of this lit panel of x-rays and would say, tell me what is going on with this patient, and you'd give the clinical history. This is a 42-year-old woman with shortness of breath and a fever, and she's got lupus. And the radiologist would say, what do you think is going on? And you'd say what you think, and the radiologist would say, no, I don't think so because it looks this way. And when you tell me this context, I'm really worried that this is a fungal infection or tuberculosis. This was incredibly instructive for me as the ordering physician, and for the radiologist who now had some context. And it was also just fun and collegial, and it was the opportunity that we had each day for what sometimes is called sense making, which is we're running around so fast all day that it was the 10 or 15 minutes a day where we kind of stopped, took a breath, and thought hard about what was going on with each patient and what the plan was. Well, about 15 years ago, radiology went digital. It did it without federal incentives, and it did it because the economics of radiology mandated it. We were no longer getting chest x-rays, which spat out two pieces of film, but now we were getting CAT scans and MRI scans that spat out 150 pieces of film. Each one cost about $4. And at the time, the cost of digital storage was plummeting, and those two curves cost, and radiology went digital over a course of a couple of years in around 2000. I've gone back to read people's writings back then to see if anybody anticipated that this would be the death of those collegial radiology rounds. And I can't find anybody who really predicted this would happen, and yet the minute that radiology went digital, it happened at breakneck speed. So almost the day before we were going down there and having these rounds, and the day after we went digital, those rounds ended. Nobody said they should end. Nobody thought ending them was a good idea. But we came to realize that part of the reason we were going down there in the first place was the only place we could see our film was the radiology department. It was what we sometimes call a forcing function. You have to go down there to look at your film, and while you're down there, you talk to the radiologist. Once radiology went digital, we no longer had to go down there to look at our film. The film was ubiquitous. I could see it on my computer anywhere else in the hospital. I could even see it in my home. Now we stopped going down to radiology, and the radiologists got very lonely very quickly, and I think they became sort of divorced from the context of what was going on. And so I don't think anybody would care that much if they were just lonely, because they make a perfectly good income and they're, it's just fine. But truly, I think those rounds, that collegial interaction, was actually quite important for patient care. Now, the next thing that happens, of course, is once the rounds end, people begin to say, why do we even need to have the radiology department in our hospital? We're just looking at the x-rays on the computer anyway. And so you move it across the street, and then you say, why do we even have to have it across the street? Why don't we have a centralized radiology reading area for 10 hospitals? So that begins to happen. And then people begin to say, you know, why don't we have the x-rays being read in India, where the radiologists cost one-tenth as much? So some of the world is flat forces that medicine has been uniquely insulated from, because pretty much everything has required in-person presence for everything we do, begin to be unleashed. So I discuss it in the book in sort of a canary in the coal mine kind of way. It was really radiology that was the first hint of how digitization really changes the geography and the communication patterns in ways that certainly we didn't predict. In retrospect, we should have, but in retrospect are sort of quite obvious that they're going to occur, but I can tell you that none of us thought about it.
Dr. Robert Wachter is author of The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. Let's continue talking about some of the harms. I don't know that radiology is a harm as such. Health IT, digitization, so many people think that things that are digital are better, and in some ways they are, but it's not like it's a panacea that's going to solve all the problems. The influx of information is overwhelming, as you've mentioned, 150 images, for example, as opposed to two. Sure, can be very helpful, but it's a lot more time, and the financial side of the entire healthcare industry is different, so that it's not like you can spend 70 times as long looking at 150 images as you could years ago looking at just the two. There's also, you talk about the irony of automation and how problems will still occur simply because people feel like, well, the system will just make sure that certain things don't happen. Can you address some of that?
Sure. I think we have seen, first thing to say that's important is there's no question, in my mind at least, that care is better and safer with computers than without it. And so my message here is not a Luddite one. It's not pull out the cords and bring back the three-ring binders and bring back the films. I actually believe my hospital in San Francisco is significantly safer than we were when it was paper. The notes are legible. It's actually a good thing that I can read the x-rays from home or from the floor. These are mostly good things. But the reason I decided to research this for a year and write it was there are these unanticipated consequences, and some of them are, like in radiology, changes in the work pattern and communication patterns that I think actually can lead to harm. But some of them are actually more sort of profound harms that I was noticing. I'll take a couple that I think are important. One, I think many patients are well aware of, which is they come in and see the doctor. And I tell the story in the book of a friend of mine said to me, you know, I went to see my doctor who I had seen a couple of years ago and I liked a lot. And as soon as I walked in the room and he asked me, you know, how am I doing? And I start talking, his head's down on the laptop, tap, tap, tap. He looks up, asks another question, his head's down on the laptop. And I said, what'd you do? And he said, I found another doctor. And you might be angry at your doctor for doing that, but I can tell you that the doctor is so busy feeding the computer because now the computer becomes this vehicle to ask all sorts of questions that essentially couldn't be asked before when it was paper. But now it's the just one more thing syndrome. It's like, well, now that the doctor's on the computer, we can ask and be sure that he or she is documenting that they asked a question about Ebola and they asked a question about smoking cessation and seatbelts and you name it. And these are all perfectly reasonable ideas, but the cumulative effect is that physicians are now looking at the computer more than they're looking at and paying attention to the patient. That's a big deal, but I'd say the bigger deal is this issue of the irony of automation and alert fatigue. And the case I tell in the book that makes this quite real is a case that happened at my hospital a few years ago where we gave a teenager 39 antibiotic pills when the correct dose was one. Luckily, the kid only had a grand mal seizure and spent a week in the ICU and didn't die, and that was just simply dumb luck. And this error began innocently enough, really, as a glitch in the way an order was written, milligrams per kilogram instead of milligrams. But then what was truly interesting was an alert fired, and the doctor ignored it. And an alert fired for the pharmacist, and the pharmacist ignored it. And you might say, you know, how could they be so careless? But our pharmacists get 150,000 alerts in a month out of 300,000 medication orders. In our intensive care unit, the electronic monitors that monitor the patient's heart rate and oxygen level, they go off in a single month in our ICUs, they go off 2.5 million times. They go off an average of once every 8 minutes by a patient's bedside, such that a researcher told me that she was talking to a nurse one day at a bedside, and the alarms were going off like bombs at Normandy. And she said to the nurse, you know, how would you even know that the patient was getting sick, or what would make you nervous about this patient? And the nurse thought for a second and said, silence. The irony of automation is as the technology gets better, the role of the human being becomes not less important, but more important. The irony, of course, and they've seen this in aviation as well, is as the technology gets better, people tend to become asleep at the switch. It's a natural thing because the technology is better and you're trusting it more and more. The final stage in this error, the 38-fold overdose, was a young nurse saw an order for 38 and a half pills. This would be like driving it on a highway and seeing a sign that said the speed limit is 2,500 miles an hour. She said, this is really odd. It's kind of weird, but I know to make it to me, it had to go through a doctor and a nurse. And then she went to this piece of technology she has, which is the barcode machine, just like the one in the supermarket. And she barcodes pill number one, and the technology says to her, the right dose is 38 and a half pills, because at that stage of the medication process, the job of the barcode is to defend the order as it's written. And that's enough for the nurse to say, okay, I guess that's right. And she barcodes 38 and a half pills and gives it to this kid. This is not unique to medicine. We've seen this in other industries, and there's a famous crash of a boat off the coast of Nantucket several years ago where the automation was telling everybody that things are okay, but there were about 15 or 20 different pieces of evidence that things were not okay and they were way off course. But you believe the computer over your own senses at times. And so these are tough problems. They're knotty problems to kind of work our way through, and I think we're beginning to see some of the consequences of them in healthcare. Part of the reason I wrote the book is I don't think we've paid enough attention to them. I think we had this magical idea. I think we got spoiled by our iPhones, that you have this idea that you take out the computer, you take out your smartphone, you download an app, you turn it on, and it's all good. We don't even read the instructions anymore. Healthcare technology is not like that. It's far more complex.
Let's use most of the rest of the time here to talk about the best possible vision, the hope side of having health IT work. You've mentioned Google and Bing. You also reference Amazon and Netflix in the book and how their use of what's broadly described as big data makes the user experience really beneficial to the end user, and how, as you put it, fuzziness in data can actually help this along. So let's have you talk broadly about some of this, and we'll get into a little more detail.
Yeah, you know, as I said, I wrote the book because I was unhappy and disappointed. And I interviewed about 90 people from very different walks of life, the leaders of technology companies, federal policymakers, practicing doctors and nurses, patients who were online. When I asked them about a variety of questions, including the role of the federal government and why the software wasn't as good as it should be, I heard very, very different answers. But when I asked people, what does this all look like when the dust settles? Everybody in the know gave me an answer that was pretty optimistic and powerfully so. And that's kind of how I settled out. It kind of surprised me and actually pleased me because, you know, I didn't want to finish all disgruntled. I think the real question is, how long does it take to get to this wonderful place? And that, I came to believe, is really not about the technology so much as about the choices we make, the way we organize ourselves, the role of the government, the incentives. What might it look like? Well, let's take the big data for one thing. If Amazon can say to me, or Netflix can say to me, customers like you who bought this book or movie also seem to like that book or movie, there is no reason that we couldn't say patients like you did better when they took treatment A versus treatment B for this particular problem. Or patients like you who had this set of signs and symptoms and lab studies turned out to have this disease, maybe not the one your doctor's thinking about, but something different. Or patients like you with this set of problems did better when they went to hospital X versus hospital Y, or saw Dr. A versus Dr. B. Analytically, there's really no fundamental difference between the analytical engine that's humming in Amazon's world or Netflix's world and what we can do once all the data are in the computer. Now, we're not there yet. It is a somewhat harder problem in that Amazon is taking a pretty constrained data set, whereas for me to figure out what you're at risk for example, I may have 1,000 pieces of data about you, and increasingly a larger data set once I have your genes, and once you might be wearing sensors. You know, the data set that I'm trying to sift through is huge, and making the decision about which pieces of data are the ones I'm trying to solve is a pretty complex decision. But I think that's all surmountable, and so that's a pretty exciting place where we can kind of predict what patients have, where we can guide them as to the best treatment for a given problem or where they should go to have their problem treated. I think in addition, now that we're all getting connected in a certain way, why should I have to drive in and take a half a day off to go see the doctor for a simple problem? It may be that I can manage myself at home with new information technology tools the way I manage my finances or my travel, whereas in the old days I needed to rely on an expert. So some of that will happen by patient self-management with good IT tools, and some of it will happen through telemedicine or other ways that you do connect with the healthcare system, but you're less dependent on the single episodic visit. You know, as I thought about all of this future state, it struck me that the technology to get there is really not the obstacle, and I think I can envision a world where we're in this pretty wonderful place in 5 to 7 years, and I can envision a world where we don't get there for about 20 years, dependent on the choices that we make.
How can health IT increase the patient's ability to be more in control of their records, their health care? You mentioned a few minutes ago the idea that, well, maybe I don't have to take a half a day off and go into the doctor because I can do this here and I can email some data, or I can take a photograph or sensors, etc.
The ability of healthcare IT to allow for patient engagement and involvement is growing quickly and is exciting, but also a double-edged sword like so much of this. Like it does in many other industries, it democratizes things. So the patient can, first of all, have access to all sorts of health information through Google and Medscape and other sites that they never had before, and that kind of levels the playing field. But increasingly, the patient can have access to their record, and they actually have a right to it. They've had the right to their record since 1995, but go to a hospital when it was using paper and say, I want to see my medical record, and they'll say, it costs you 50 cents a page, and we'll have it ready for you in 3 weeks. Whereas once the record is digital, all that stands between you and your medical record is a password. For about 5 million patients in the United States today, not only can they see their laboratory results and x-rays, many tens of millions of patients can do that, but they can actually read their doctor's notes. And so you're beginning to see a new way of organizing healthcare where the patients have the information they might need and might want to become much more active participants in their care. For many patients, that's incredibly exciting and liberating, and the tools have to get better because for the patient to read my note, well, you know, I write a lot in Latin and they may not understand all of it, but you could see the development of translation tools, plus maybe some new ways of educating doctors to make sure the notes are accessible. So you're going to see some innovations there where patients really have access to their information and it is given to them in a form that allows them to fully use it. That's quite exciting. It also allows patients access to other patients. In a chapter, I profile a company called Smart Patients, which is a peer-to-peer community. So a patient gets a new diagnosis of a kidney cancer. And in the old days, they were dependent on that visit to the doctor to figure out what this was about and what I should do and what my prognosis is. Well, now a patient goes online and goes into the kidney cancer portal, and there are hundreds of other patients with kidney cancer who know what you're going through. And so I was really impressed by the degree of richness of those interactions and how comforting that was for many patients. Where this gets a little dicey, I think, is the idea that you are self-managing your travel. Well, you're probably not going to screw it up that badly. Your finances, well, maybe a little bit more chance. Your health care, I think the chances are higher. And I tell the story in the book of a physician whose name was Franz Ingelfinger. And Ingelfinger was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. So Ingelfinger went to a variety of physicians to figure out what to do about this cancer. And with each one, the physician said to him, well, Franz, what would you do? You're the world's expert on this cancer. And he found himself getting more and more anxious and more frantic. And finally, he went to see an old friend, a wise friend, and the friend said, Franz, what you really need is a doctor. And what he meant by that was you actually need someone to be a little paternalistic. That's a term that's grown out of fashion. But when you have cancer, I don't think you really want people to be spending all of their energy asking you what you want to do. Many patients want someone to take your hand, listen to you, understand your values, but really help you make the right decision. Well, this was the world's expert. Think about a patient who has no medical knowledge in an environment now where they have high copays, high deductibles, so some financial reason to care for themselves. And so this is going to be tricky to get right. I mean, we really do want patients to manage themselves as well as possible when that's the right thing to do, a cold or maybe even managing their blood pressure. We don't want them to have to see a doctor where they could get easily, you know, the right care from a nurse practitioner or someone cheaper. But there are going to be times, plenty of times, where you really do need to see a credentialed expert. And using all of the modern IT tools and using them to not only provide better care, but to educate you in ways that are helpful. But what I worry about is this idea that we're going to go digital. It's democratizing healthcare. Patients will now be able to do all of it themselves. We're not really going to need doctors anymore. I still think we are, and I think if we take this idea too far, we will be creating a huge amount of anxiety, and there will be a fair number of patients who make some pretty bad decisions.
And that was an excerpt of Dr. Robert Wachter, author of The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age, speaking with independent radio producer and former weekly KBOO host Andrew Geller. The full hour-long interview will be available on Andrew Geller's blog at andrewgeller.me or his Audio Insight, that's INCITE podcast via iTunes. And don't forget to check out the Open Source Bridge Conference 2015. That's June 23rd through the 26th at the Elliott Center in downtown Portland. Thanks so much for tuning in today to The Digital Divide. Be sure and tune us on every second Friday of the month at 11 a.m. This is your host, Rabia Yeaman. Until next month, have a great life.
Sing songs, it'll prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KABU.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot
we It's time for the KBOO News at noon for Friday, June 12th. For KBOO News, I'm Kristen Yount. At Binghamton University in New York, a scientist, Seokhan Choi, otherwise known as Sean, made a battery which runs on the microbial respiration of bacteria. One drop of bacteria-laden water on a piece of paper, folded into a packet that provides the growth medium, is enough to create an action potential. Choi lined up four matchbook-sized packets to turn on an LED light. Biosensors made out of the paper make an ideal medium because it wicks up solution without plastic syringes. Good for far-flung laboratories. The National Science Foundation awarded Choi with a $300,000 scholarship. Yesterday, the head of the union called the American Federation of Government Employees asserted that a cyber attack, which occurred back in December, left federal employees more vulnerable than was once thought. Hackers have had access to the servers of the Office of Personnel Management for months, harvesting information from them the whole time. In Bonn, Germany, the UN Convention on Climate Change agreed to stop deforestation by paying countries to keep their trees standing. The agreement produced at the two-week-long conference surprised forest advocacy groups. The matters of financing and implementation have yet to be ironed out. The program called RED, R-E-D-D plus, stands for Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation. Richard Meeker, marital partner of Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenberg and publisher of the Willamette Week, will leave his post as of July 1st. The self-proclaimed alternative weekly will be in the hands of editor Mark Zussman. Meeker will turn to other outlets in North Carolina and New Mexico, which are part of Rose City Papers. It's going to do it for the KBOO News today. Please tune in every weekday at 5 p.m. for the latest in local, national, and international news brought to you by dedicated volunteers from our Southeast Portland studios.
You're listening to KBOO